Well, hello. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, November 22nd. No, 26th. I'm Ray Graff. Time has come for another science forum. Yes, another one. It's our panel of experts back again to field your scientific inquiries. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Anything in the natural world bugging you? You don't know what it means or how it got that way? This crew knows. 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org with your science questions, or 800-348-2551. The science team is ready. We'll break for some news, catch our breath, and then it's science all the way. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Yeah, it's the science forum today, and I'm going to be honest. I think the scientists have been hitting the absinthe this afternoon because here are the topics we have. Ready? This is what they brought forth. Milking the seal, skunk stink, fiber from beer, and hen's teeth. Milking the seal, skunk stink, fiber from beer, and hen's teeth. I don't know where they came up with this stuff, but we're going to talk about it. The number is 800-348-2551. Pour yourself a refreshing glass of seal milk and sit back. 800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Let's have our our team of esteemed scientists sign in, please. Barbara, are you? You're Barbara, right?
I say I'm Barbara Brabets. Okay. I am a biochemist. I am responsible for the seal milk debacle that we're about to have.
Oh, this is
going
to be fun.
I'm from SUNY Cobleskill, where no seals are harmed in the production of education.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm a retired organic chemist. And unless somebody calls in with something better, I'm going to talk about skunk stink.
I'm so excited about this. This might win us that award that has been so elusive over my entire career.
And I am Ed Stander, and I'm going to talk about hen's teeth because I was sure that Ray was going to mention that having a science forum on Wednesday was as rare as hen's teeth. So I looked it up to find out if they were rare or not.
Wow, I didn't even know it was Wednesday. So I'm glad that you guys are here. You know what? This is the last show before Thanksgiving, and thankfully, that's the case. 800-348-2551. Let's begin with the heady world of, well, frankly, the seal dairy market. Barbara, tell us what you're talking about.
So researchers have been investigating the nutritional qualities of milk. And when we say milk, we mean, you know, that stuff that mammals produce. So far, I don't think they've milked a platypus, so we have yet to hear about that one.
Yeah.
But in looking at so the gold standard of milk complexity has always been attributed to humans. And really, milk has three components. It has the protein that, you know, lets bones grow,
right?
And that helps with the muscle development. It has the fats that we either add or take out, depending on whether we want the heavy cream or if we want skim milk.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it is sugar. And the sugars, we say sugar like it's one sugar, but it's really a whole bunch. It's lactose, which we've all heard of. And then there are these longer sugar chains called oligosaccharides, basically chained together sugars, starches, human milk has somewhere between 100 and 200 different kinds of these sugars that are in there. Not molecules, individual molecules, but different kinds of molecules.
Right.
And what that does is it allows us to get the energy from the milk, but it also helps to feed the microbiome in a developing baby gut. If you think about baby poo at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it needs to evolve, and it does so by ingesting milk, and then that helps the good bacteria in your gut flourish, which kind of changes the overall digestibility of food. So that's why we can go from a purely milk diet as an infant to then be able to have the ability to break down other more complex foods. So they went to go look. They didn't like go milk a seal. They actually found somebody who'd already done the job of finding gray seal milk to test it for something else, and then thawed it from the freezer and then looked at it, and it had almost double the number of types of oligosaccharides, those specialty sugars. And they're not exactly sure why seals have such a complex variety of sugars that are in its milk, but it does lead them to the top of the obscure fact of who's got the most complex milk. And it's apparently a seal at the moment.
And I should add that it's won the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval.
Oh, yarr.
So milking of the seal, okay, that's
right.
Fine.
I went to go look that up and I couldn't find much about that. But they only needed about 3 tablespoons, I think it said, to be able to do the test. But once you're in it to milk the seal, you might as well get more than 3 tablespoons.
Absolutely. And have they milked all the mammals yet?
No, I think there are other mammals yet to be milked. I don't think this particular research group is up for it, but I think there are probably volunteers out there on the internet who are willing to do the
That is disturbing, but you're probably correct.
Right, and watch out for that platypus because they have those poison darts on their legs that you can die from getting too close to a platypus.
Know that. Where are they from? Australia? Where do they live?
Yeah, they're down under. Yep, and they can. There is a guy who got too close. They're pretty mellow.
Unless you
try to milk them, and then there is a guy. I think it was 2023 or 2024 who actually died from platypus poisoning. Yeah.
Now I remember a Mr. Rogers episode where he had a duckbill platypus. That's the only time I've actually
seen
one.
That's awesome. Good for you, Fred.
1971.
Yeah, I'm sure that that's not going to happen these days.
All right, fair enough. Well, I don't think Fred Rogers is going to do milking any platypus.
Yeah, I'm sure that platypus isn't around either.
You know, you mentioned the fat content of milk,
yes.
And then you mentioned heavy cream.
Yeah.
So, when we get a 2% milk,
yes,
it's not like whole milk is 100% fat.
No,
what is the fat content?
3.5%.
I saw that on a sign.
It's only about 3.5% fat. And so you take it from 3.5% down to 2%. So it feels like 98% of the fat's been removed, but it's not. It's not even half.
Yeah.
Right? You've got about 2/3 of the fat there that you had to begin with.
Here's the funny thing. I saw a sign about that in your neck of the woods, somewhere on the way to Cobleskill, on the road. There is a farm that has that sign.
Painted on a hay bale.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it got me thinking, and now I'm back on the whole milk.
Yeah.
It's great. In fact, just seal milk now. It's amazing.
I think you can only get that at Whole Foods.
Delicious. Mm-hmm. All right. What's all this about skunk stink, Jim?
Well, here in perusing my chemical and engineering news, there's this graphic on what makes skunk spray stink. And, I mean, it's been well known that there are sulfur-containing compounds in there that are volatile and, in general, those kinds of compounds smell really bad.
Yeah.
A little pinch of them is what they put into natural gas.
Really?
So that you can smell it.
To give the odorant.
Oh.
So you can smell it.
Because the gas is otherwise odorless.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So anyway, skunk spray contains a ton of these things. And what's kind of interesting is that they also contain kind of a masked version of this compound. It's called an ester or a thioester.
Okay.
So it itself doesn't smell too bad, but when it gets wet, it will break down to give the stinky stuff. So that's why, as it says in here, your dog gets sprayed by a skunk, you try to wash it off, and he smells worse.
Even with tomato juice.
Well, okay. And then there's a controversial paragraph here.
All right.
And yes, it's already, there's been infighting here amongst the
Indeed.
Panel.
And
Indeed.
The callers are going to jam the lines.
Yeah. They are alleging that tomato juice is not particularly effective in de-skunking.
Okay. Now, Ed was very, very forceful in his denial of that.
Yes, and I appreciate you.
Really? Please.
All right.
Tearing him off from me as he was trying to strangle.
Exactly.
Me.
And thanks for not getting hurt.
Toxic
workplace. All right. So, Ed, why do you think you've seen it work?
Oh, of course I've seen it work.
Not only does it work
well on the cat, on my dog, but I've used spaghetti sauce and it works just as well. Superb.
I have always thought that the tomato juice was just overwhelming it with another smell that nobody really wanted to smell. And so you'd kind of like, everything would just be tomato-y and you'd be like, oh, okay, it's tomato-y with a side of skunk.
Yeah, that's what they kind of allege here. But people generally don't have, they may have a little jar of spaghetti sauce at home, but generally don't have large quantities of
Unless your mama's Celeste, and then you got tons of it in the back.
Right. They suggest you take your bottle of 3% hydrogen peroxide which again, you may or may not have, and with some baking soda and dish detergent, because what that does is converts these sulfur compounds
into alcohols.
Into acids.
Interesting.
Which are, one, not very volatile, and two, don't smell nearly as bad. And that is likely, that makes sense chemically, that a little hydrogen peroxide, baking soda, and detergent or dish detergent.
People can be pretty desperate when their animal gets sprayed by a skunk, though. So I do know that in the past, I had a visiting dog who decided on a hot, on a warm February morning to go for a walk and ended up with a skunk full of face skunk smell.
Yeah.
And I knew I had the peroxide at home, and I'm enough of a chemist to be able to do that. But I'm like, you know, I don't want my whole house smelling like this all winter. So I went to the store and I bought the enzyme, the Nature's Miracle enzyme.
Yeah.
And that's supposed to break it down as effectively, if not. But it's seriously expensive compared to a bottle of hydrogen peroxide and some Dawn dish soap.
Could you water it down a little bit?
Well, you kind of do in a way, because you spray it on the dog, you leave it on the dog, and then you wash the dog.
Yeah.
But, I think there were like four or five baths until I could tolerate the smell.
Mercy.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break here in a moment. We have some more topics, including hen's teeth and fiber from beer ahead. If you want to join in, and Lord knows where this show's going, 800-348-2551 is our number, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. How about a little M Squad theme from Basie? Vox Pop on WAMC. It's the Science Forum. Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Barb Rabbits join us today. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Fred writes in, have you noticed skunk spray, coffee, and cannabis all have a similar note? Why?
Sulfur.
Coffee has some sulfurs, but not a lot of sulfurs.
Is it the esters?
Cannabis has a lot. Sure. It's not the esters. They're the thiol. So it's a sulfur with an H on the end. I'm trying to think of the component in coffee that would be sulfur rich. I mean, it all depends on where your coffee's grown. There's going to be those with a smoother note and those with a more harsh note, and that really just comes from the soils that they're grown in, and that's taken up into the bean. It's not caffeine. Caffeine in and of itself does not have any sulfurs on it.
I've never noticed that coffee smells like skunk. Actually,
no. Although I think that maybe when it's not yet perked. There might be, if it's good coffee, you might get a whiff of that.
It's not perky.
Now, out by the bus stop, I can tell you that sometimes it smells a lot like skunk, and it's not a skunk.
Downtown so
getting
Albany.
back to Fred's comment about cannabis, what is it about skunk juice? And I'm looking at you, Jim, because you're the chemist, not because you're that familiar with the cannabis. But what is it that is so close? I mean, it does smell like a skunk.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Barb's looking it up, which is cheating, frankly.
I am cheating for, it's close to Thanksgiving.
The number's 800, is that the excuse? 800-348-2551. Ed, you brought up hen's teeth, which I thought was just sort of a thing people said because there are no hen's teeth.
Well,
but apparently somebody grew hen's teeth.
Well,
why?
First of all, hens do have a tooth sometimes, apparently.
Really?
On the top of its nose.
What?
Which is used to break
It's not a nose, it's a beak.
It's a beak. Excuse me. It's a nose.
Okay.
It's a beak. Beak,
okay.
You know, that thing there.
Yeah.
And so that could be called a tooth, but it really isn't a tooth. So they did some gene splicing on what do you call it?
They did gene activation.
Activation, yeah.
Where? How do you do that?
Not to take Ed's glory away on this wonderful subject, but... The chickens still have the gene for teeth left over from the dinosaur age, and it's just turned off.
But no, what I'm saying is, how do you turn it off?
So when you turn it, turn it off because it's again to chemistry, it's methylated, which means there's a special group that's stuck on the DNA at that point that says, hey, don't look at this part. We're not going to use this part. It's kind of like putting a line through something in a essay, and you can take that methyl group off. Or just take the old gene with its methyl groups out and then insert a new gene using CRISPR-Cas with the methyl groups gone, and then that turns it from a deactivated state to an activated state.
So Ed, these teeth that they, when they reactivated it and they grew the teeth, they looked like dinosaur teeth?
Well, effectively alligator teeth.
Amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes you have to eat.
Right.
Each other, apparently.
Obviously.
Oof. So that's a throwback to millions of years ago.
Right. And we have genes like this, too. But in humans, we're not allowed to experiment on human genomes to do these types of things. So.
But you'll see mutations from time to time, right? Prehensile
sure.
tails
right.
and things
or
like this.
Or the sixth finger or yeah. a little, yeah. Well, we don't get a prehensile tail. We get a tiny vestigial tail, the
vestigial
tiny
tail,
right, that sometimes is removed because it's difficult to sit down for most of your life. Yeah. So, yeah, we have all kinds of vestigial genes that are out there. We even have genes to form gills and stuff that are left over from evolutionary ancestors.
That is so interesting. And by the way, it's the Science Forum with Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barb Rabbits. The number is 800-348-2551. You've seen Creature from the Black Lagoon.
I have.
So that was based on quasi-fact.
I don't know about standing up and looking like he's wearing a loincloth. But, yeah, I think beyond that, everything was pretty genetically accurate. Yeah. I mean, we call them protogenes. They're turned off genes. They're these genes that are obsolete that are not activated in that species.
Yeah.
But now that we're doing enough genetic studies from one animal to another or one plant to an animal, we can look to see where those sequences are similar or the same and identify them in what we used to call junk DNA, DNA that wasn't expressed. But our junk DNA just seems to be kind of like previous drafts of our ancestors.
You know, I was watching a show on the History Channel. I think it was the History Channel on the weekend. David Duchovny, something about secrets. And in Stalin's Russia, they were trying to breed chimpanzees with humans.
Oh, gosh.
Have you ever seen this?
No, I hadn't. Thank God.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
Really terrifying.
Well, that's why we have the rules, guys.
They fed them on seal's milk, too. So it all goes back.
You know, Ed, that's not helpful. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. And before we get to the emails and such, there was one more topic. Oh, yeah, fiber from beer. Jim Pickett, what did you mean by this?
This is another article and comes from Engineering News. A team extracted proteins from spent beer brewing yeast and spun them into strong textile fibers. And there's a picture here of a model wearing a sweater, apparently knitted from these fibers. So it was just, I think, an exercise in showing that you can make fibers from other things than what we currently do.
Has anybody done it?
And yeah. I
mean, can you make a shirt out of it?
Yeah, they
did.
That's not the question.
They made,
can you make beer out of a shirt?
They made,
get beer out of a shirt after a long night. I'll just wring it out. I'll tell you that.
No, they made, would be 1,000 pounds, 500 kilograms of this stuff.
So really? It's kind of like a waste to, you know, it's zero cycling. Like it's recycling materials that otherwise would be a waste product.
Yeah. And the thing is that these fibers apparently break down pretty quickly in the soil. So it would be fibers that are rapidly degradable.
So that's a good thing, right?
I was worried that you were going to say they were going to break down quickly in a shirt because that could be like, you know, your afternoon meeting could get really funky.
It would require a miracle for this to become commercial.
Right.
But
you wouldn't want to wash them.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a question of how many times you could wash them before they would die.
Well, my digging into the interwebs has given me actually a scientific article on the cannabinoid thiol. So within cannabis, so there are 7 thiols, these sulfur-containing compounds that are found in skunk spray. And one of the largest one is called 3-methyl-2-butene-1-thiol, or 3-2-1-MBT, and that is the one that is made in very, very small quantities in the cannabis plant, but then it's concentrated in the process of making the oil. So the oils are where a lot of these thiols end up. So if you have an oil-rich cannabis product, you know, then you're going to get more of the skunk smell than if you don't have an oily product.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, when a skunk unleashes the scent, does that hurt the skunk? I've always heard that it was a painful process.
I've heard that the babies can get like skunk poisoning, skunk spray poisoning from their parents if their parents don't have like control over their own skunk spray.
Interesting. But it's not harmful. It doesn't hurt the sprayer. is my point.
Well, it can, but, you know, it mostly, the only way to really hurt another animal with the skunk spray is you have to ingest it. So it has to either be breathed in or you have to like eat something with a lot of it in it. And in fact, these sulfur containing compounds can cause a toxicity in domestic animals like dogs and cats,
yeah.
especially if they're little, because it screws up their red blood cells. And they get something similar to what like a sickle cell attack would be, only in a dog or a cat.
The reason I ask whether it hurts them, whether they try to avoid unleashing the scent. We have a huge skunk that we saw the other night walk ambling in the back 40 of our yard. I mean, this thing was the size of a seal. Not joking. It was
right.
huge. And, you know, we wondered. It just went on its way, and we didn't care. I kind of like them. They're fun to look at. But they're not going to seek you out and zap you.
No, really not. I watch a couple of channels on the internet when I can. On wildlife rehabbers, and they very infrequently get sprayed, even though the animals are usually in distress, even though they're doing things like handling their wounds or trying to feed them. And what they say is there's a bunch of verbal signs and then sounds that the skunk will make in anticipation before they spray
you.
So
you know to run.
Right. And so there's a kind of, it's hard to do on the radio, but kind of like a pounding of the ground with their two front paws. So if they kind of give you like a linebacker stance in a football line and kind of make that thump, then you know that you're on track to get sprayed.
Okay, let's go to line one here, 800-348-2551. Because skunks are fun to talk about, Joanne in Hadley is on. Joanne. Hello? That's
not a hello?
Oh, hi, you're there. Go ahead.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed.
I was calling about, you were talking about the fragrances from coffee and marijuana and stuff.
Yeah.
I think it could be from terpenes.
Well, some terpenes do have a fragrance. And certainly in coffee, that's one of the most delightful fragrances that people like about coffee. Even if it's not brewed coffee, just the grinding of the coffee, those terpenes get volatilized into the air. And it's kind of that woodsy smell, that nutty woodsy smell. Terpenes don't contain sulfur, but they are aromatic in the sense that they're very fragrant. So it could be, and I don't smell terpenes at all in marijuana. In fact, the smell of marijuana is, those around me know, I really don't like it because I think it just smells like skunk. It's kind of like me with cilantro, right? I've got the soap thing for cilantro. So when I smell cannabis, it's like, why would anybody put that in their mouth? So, you know, to each his own. We all have different receptors and the ability to interpret these smells. But terpenes themselves, although smelly in a good way, don't, to me, smell like thiol. So thiol's the sulfur smell.
All right. Joanne.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. Is our number. I don't know who wrote this. Go ahead.
We have another one. I think Ed and you were both talking earlier about Mars.
Well, I did a news story in Midday Magazine. I just read a little brief news item that they had recorded. One of the Mars rovers had recorded sound, which they have deduced is the sound of thunder, lightning on Mars.
Awesome.
Which is common, I guess, on Saturn and Jupiter and Earth, obviously. Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, just the comment is that usually lightning is produced in clouds, for example, by ice crystals rubbing together. And as they rub together, they produce a static charge, and that builds up to the point where you get lightning forming. And you'll get the same thing, for example, if you take very fine pieces of quartz. So in the case of Mars, you'd expect that if there were major dust storms, that stuff on the surface, which is probably very high in silica, would wind up producing lightning and the associated thunder.
Well, and the atmosphere is so thin, would the hertz, would the tone of the thunder be different on Mars because the atmosphere is
I'm
thinner?
I'm sure you'd hear the crackling.
Ah.
But not a boom.
The boom.
But, interesting.
Because there's not that much to boom together.
Right.
You know, you mentioned quartz and the electrical properties of quartz. And then, of course, you have quartz crystals and old radios and everything
watches.
Else. There is this Neolithic site in France, and I forget the name of it, but it's hundreds of stones, and they're lined up. But apparently, lots of quartz in this stone. Is there anything that can be any phenomenon that can be generated from a bunch of heavily quartz-infested stones in a line or anything like that. I mean, this is what has been postulated for years and years and years.
Yeah. Well, people who study that sort of stuff, especially people who are really into astrology and such, will argue that quartz lined up produces a field, an energy field that allows things to last longer. For example, they make these quartz pyramids so you can stick a razor blade inside and it'll stay sharp all the time. But there's never been any proof whatsoever that it actually happens, but that's the basic notion, and it's been around forever.
Have they studied it, or?
Not that I know of.
So would there be more lightning strikes into quartz rock, given the phenomenon that we talked about on Mars?
No, it's just the rubbing it together of the quartz particles that produce the static charge that start it. So it shouldn't make any difference as far as what rock it hits, and there wouldn't be any reason for it to actually be related to quartz itself.
Are so-called earthquake lights related to quartz content in the ground?
That's one of the suggestions, yes. One of the other possibilities is that when the earthquake is occurring, gases are coming out of the ground and that's producing it. Which brings us to another subject that that Jim had before, on the subject of where these gases in these lights in the middle of swamps come from.
Swamp gas.
The will of the wisp. It's been known, I guess, from what I read here, that it's a oxidation of methane, basically natural gas, that's produced that gives the light. It's not really a flame.
Is it a glow?
It's a glow.
Hmm.
So it's a lower temperature oxidation that gives off the light rather than an actual flame.
You know, in 1966 in Michigan, and you guys probably, I was 2 years old, so I don't remember it, but I remember reading about it. There was a pretty large number of UFO sightings around this college in Michigan. Gerald Ford got involved with it at the time. And J. Allen Hynek, who was the Air Force UFO investigator, said, yeah, there was a swamp right here. It's probably swamp gas. And he was ridiculed for that.
Well, anyway, this is a real phenomenon. A question, what's been resolved recently is how these get ignited. So, you see bubbles of the gas coming up all the time, but what the finding was that when bubbles come up under right conditions and spray pop and spray, you can get, as Ed said, with rubbing sand together, the bubbles, the little droplets of water that can come off, can generate electric charges.
But this is just an instantaneous thing, right?
Yes. So you get the electric charges, and then there can be a discharge, a teeny tiny spark between particles. So,
and that should be enough to do the job.
Nano lightning, but that could be enough to start the oxidation and cause the phenomenon.
It's the Science Forum today. Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabets join us. 800-348-2551 is our number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Somebody about to say something?
Nope.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll go to Terry in Guilford, Connecticut. Terry, you're on.
Hi. I read somewhere that quartz in the earth sometimes has little particles in some locations of gold in it that was brought in through like hydrothermal water that's under intense pressure, like water that's trapped. I guess they call that superheated, like much hotter than it would be like water in the atmosphere because it's confined and it can carry particles of gold. And I was reading somewhere that there could be like magnetic fields or something also, that somehow there was a theory that it could cause like if there's any little bits of gold in the quartz that it kind of like all kind of clings to it and kind of like clumps together over a period of time under the right conditions.
Well, I can tell you that generally speaking, when a magma body, a body of molten rock in the earth, cools, the last thing that cools out of that body usually are quartz and rare metals.
Huh.
So, for example, if you have one of these bodies and it undergoes a bit of tectonic pressure and this stuff shoots out into joints or veins along the way, then the quartz and the gold will go together. And, of course, if you're going out looking for gold, if one of the first things you look for is these quartz veins, because that's where you usually find the gold.
Aha.
So it doesn't have to be hydrothermal. It doesn't have to come in later. It comes in at the same time as the quartz.
Yeah, I recall reading a very recent article. Jeez, it's hard for me to remember the details. But the point of the article was that electric fields from strained quartz doing, as the caller said, precipitating out the gold.
Well, the gold is there.
Yeah.
So the precipitation is just a matter of cooling it off one way or another. So whether it's magnetic or not, it'd be really hard to prove.
Terry, thanks for the call. All right, here's one along these lines. Well, I don't know, really. This is from Nick, who says, I think there might be some kind of magnetic or energy streak line going through our backyard relating to the earth as a whole. Trees and garden plants, quite far apart, along, grow much more lushly than anything around them. Is it possible or potentially plausible? And that's from Nick.
Well, I mean, ley lines are a thing, but they don't necessarily have a correlation with growth.
Okay, ley lines are a thing. Have they been mapped to a scientific degree of accuracy?
That's beyond the scope of what I understand.
You're the geologist. What do you think?
I'll let this one lay.
Well, for example, my limited knowledge of ley lines comes from understanding the magnetic pull that that the Earth has on migrating birds, for example. So certain migrating birds migrate by sight. So if you're a juvenile, so for example, a hawk. So if you're a juvenile hawk, what you're going to do is you're going to follow some of the slightly more older juvenile hawks south, for example, along the East Coast, but you're going to stay inland or you're going to follow the coast more. But there's danger in following the coast because of weather, because, you know, fall weather is always so unpredictable.
Yep.
So what happens is when you get to, say, northern Florida and spend the winter there, and then you're going to come back to your area in the spring, you're going to follow the older hawks back up north. So that's all visual cues. And the older hawks tend to go more inland along, say, the Blue Ridge, as opposed to along the shore. So the juveniles kind of hang to the shore until they know the route, and then once they know the route, they stay inland.
Yeah.
For things like a pigeon, right, that is notorious for being able to be magnetically sensitive, you could blindfold a pigeon and it can follow where it needs to go, right? It just has...
But those are just lines of magnetic force,
those
right?
Lines of magnetic
but
force.
But ley lines are postulated to be going through the earth, right?
True.
And so... You have all these stone features in England and throughout Europe, really, and even in the U.S., perhaps, that are allegedly along these lines.
Correct.
But
we don't know.
What do they do?
Right. How do you measure it?
Yeah, I'd love to know. Let's take a break. We're way overdue. 800-348-2551. The Science Forum, even more all over the place than usual. Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabets, we'll be back. It's Vox Pop, the Science Forum. Ray Graff with you, joined by Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabets today. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Remember way back when we talked about milking the seal?
Oh, yes.
Here's a question about milk. Not necessarily seal milk, although it doesn't say. Don't know who wrote it. You mentioned the fat content and nutritional value of whole milk. I've been seeing A2 milk. How is that altered from regular milk, or is it a different breed of cow? Plus, what's the value?
I don't know what an A2 milk
is. I've never heard of this.
No, me neither. I wonder if it's a specific breed of cow, like Ayrshire and Angus or something, because you're going to get different milk content and fat content and protein content, depending on your breed. For example, Jerseys are known to be the cow you want to use to make ice cream because the quality of their cream is such that you're going to get a much fuller flavored ice cream out of them.
Better for chocolate, too.
Yeah. And so if you want pounds, right, if you want pounds of milk, that is, then that's how you measure milk. When you milk cows, you want Holstein because they're just going to create more volume of milk, milk.
You say volume and weight,
but they measure it by pounds. So
why?
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of why do we approximate the weight of an elephant by how many dishwashers it weighs? Like we use these weird units of measure, all the time. How many swimming pools full of water go over Niagara Falls at any one time? Like we just use these random units. But anyway, so pounds for milk is what the industry uses.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
My guess is it probably came from weighing milk cans.
Well, probably. But I mean, at a certain point, you're weighing the milk when it goes into the milk truck to take it away from your farm in modern times. But
yeah. But, I mean, I'm old. I grew up, it was a dairy farm when I was little, and I remember my still using milk cans.
Huh.
So because the volume's going to be variable on how full the can is, I'm guessing they probably weigh them, weigh them full, weigh them empty, and then they know how much to pay the farmer.
The number here is 800-348-2551, and the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Before the next email, Ed, I just saw on the news on the sort of not hearing it, but seeing it, that a volcano somewhere has erupted for the first time in 12,000 years?
Ethiopia, I believe.
And what's the deal?
Oh, it happens. Volcanoes can be dead for 10,000, 12,000 years and then come back to life.
What's the difference between dormant and dead?
Dormant means they're going to come back to life at some point.
So this was a dormant volcano.
This was a dormant volcano.
Can they be mischaracterized and say, oh, this one's dead, and then it's not dead?
Well, they can be dead for years and years and years and then come back to life. Because what's happening is as the plates go underneath each other and start to melt, then you start getting it to happen. And to some extent, it depends a lot on the quartz, going back to quartz, the quartz content of the land. If there's a lot of quartz that the magma has to come through, it becomes very, very sticky. And it can take 10,000, 12,000 years to come up to the surface.
Huh. All right. Michael in Rhinebeck writes, why was the biggest, newest gold discovery in China not discovered sooner? I don't know how you answer that, but go ahead, Ed. It's on you.
That's what geologists do is they go out and they look in places, and chances are that one was probably in a rather desert location, probably far away from everything.
All right. Back to the phones we go. 800-348-2551. Tim is in Troy. Hello, Tim.
Hello. I've got a question about ley lines. They're kind of fascinating to me. Back in the days of the New Age, 95 or so, I was reading about them, and the book said that they were discovered by a British fellow who climbed into the church steeple and noticed that all the church steeples lined up in rows and knew that churches had often been built on old sacred sites. And so he came up with this theory of ley lines. And I've always wondered, are they magnetic? Are they something else? Has there been any research done on this?
Yeah, we're not the people to ask about that because I think we've exhausted our ley lines knowledge in the last call.
Right.
But I do know that churches are often followed the Roman roads. Roman roads tended to be straight. So the Roman roads, for example, in Britain were built straight so that the armies could penetrate north as quickly as possible. And then the villages sprung off of those very straight roads. So you can still see them even from space.
Tim, thanks a lot. When I was talking about these stones in France, it was Carnac. Mm-hmm. And Glenn in the 845 wrote in, and I don't have this confirmed, but this is what Glenn says. Not only do the large megaliths in Karnak, and it's an amazing thing to see, they go on for miles, and they're pretty straight lines. Not only do the large megaliths in Karnak have quartz properties, they are also lined up with their north and south polarity in the same orientation. Is that a thing, and should we be impressed, Ed?
No, because north and south locations change over time. So if they're lined up now, you might be able to figure out when they were. By the fact that north and south lines change over time as the North Pole moves, the magnetic north pole moves. You should be able to figure out how old it is if it's related to the north and south lines, but they're not going to be lined up with it today.
It's still a fascinating thing to see. It's incredible. 800-348-2551 is the number. Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabets, and Ed Stander join us. Keith is in Port Jervis. Keith, how's the weather in Port Jervis today?
Oh, it's kind of gray. Not raining, but gray.
Okay.
But you were just talking about the milk.
Yeah.
And I had a wonderful experience. Our vacations were on my cousin's farm. So they got free labor in the summer, and we had fun.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking that if you take a milk can and you fill it up from a certain cow's milk, some cows have more milk fat than others. So the volume would be the same, but the weight, if it was heavier for the volume that it could contain, would give you an indication of the milk fat in that breed's milk.
It's a good
thought. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it certainly is true.
Okay, so I think that might be an answer to the question.
All right.
Different cows. And I want to say something else. My cousin who ran the farm was Down syndrome. And nothing to say except for it was an environment that he was the master of. He was birthing the cows, milking the cows, teaching us about cows. So an example of somebody with a disability being in an environment that they could master, he was the happiest fellow.
I love that.
And I'm told Down syndrome don't live past 56. He lived almost to 70.
Wow, that's great.
Keith, thank you for that. That's a great call.
You know, I'm going to take the pounds of milk as homework. I work at a ag and tech college and am in the Department of Animal Science, and I sit next to dairy professors in my meetings. So I am going to take that and find out what the real history of it is and see if we're close.
By the way, could there be a more beautiful spot to have a college? It's so
it
great
is gorgeous.
Down there.
And
gosh.
Boy, for fall, it was beautiful. Even though the drought was there and the leaves weren't quite as brilliant, it was just pretty.
I'm going to make a suggestion.
Sure.
That the pounds comes from Britain originally.
Oh, like that kind of pounds of
just
milk.
Just watch.
Really?
You mean like the currency?
The currency.
Oh,
yes.
Interesting.
The number here is 800-348-2551 Science Forum. And let's go to Wyatt in Bristol, Vermont. Wyatt, you're on. Can you turn your radio down a little bit? Okay.
Hi. You mentioned that pigeons were magnetically sensitive, and I was just curious about like how that sense manifests and if it's unique to pigeons or if it's in other animals. And like what's going on there genetically and all of that.
I think it's cool to think about
this. In my limited knowledge, again, I'm a bird nerd, so that's how I know about the pigeons and the hawks. But there are other birds that have a similar sensitivity. And they attribute some of the weirdness that happens right before an earthquake to that disturbance of the magnetic field that may be happening. And that's why the birds fly weird. So there are other animals for sure. They've looked at the brain centers of pigeons, and in certain locations of the brain, if they deactivate that, then the birds lose their sense of spatial recognition. They can't orient north, south, east, west anymore. So they've located the area of the brain. Now they're getting to the point where they can do little like MRIs of the brain on the pigeon itself, but they're having to scale this down to miniature to be able to obviously fit a pigeon head, like give them a little MRI helmet to wear while they fly. But we're really getting close to being able to unlock that kind of magnetic connection and where exactly in the brain it is and what's going on in the brain at that time. In my general bio course, a long time ago, we used to deal with frogs because we'd use them as an anatomical model. And they have a photo spot that's on a thin part of their skull is very thin in a certain place just above their eyes. And if you cover that photo spot up with duct tape, then the frogs cannot orient to the sun. So, and it's a way for this thermally unregulated animal to be able to find the sun. So in a way, it's not a magnetic compass. It's more of a sun compass. But they have this photo spot on the top of their skull so that they know where the sun is. So other animals have ways to orient in space beyond like looking at Google Earth, but it's a wide variety of adaptations over the last 3 billion years.
And I understand that the pigeons also, they've found nanoparticles of magnetite in their brains.
Yes, they have. If you do not give a pigeon iron, like if you do not allow them from birth to have any iron, they also lose this capability.
Thanks, Wyatt. Is it possible that other animals, mammals perhaps, would have bits of magnetite in their brains?
Absolutely, sure. And so, you wonder, like large herding animals like the caribou that have to go large distances in order to really get to their food sources, how do they orient themselves as well?
So what happens when the magnetic poles finally shift?
They shift.
That's been a question for a long time. When it suddenly north goes south and south goes north, do the birds suddenly go north for the winter?
Oh, interesting.
And
you wonder what kind of disruption they'll be, because it's, what, every 11,000 years or so?
11,000 years, yeah.
So pigeons have been around a lot longer than 11,000 years.
And so presumably then the dinosaurs had that too, right?
Sure.
We're overdue for the shift, aren't we?
Well, it varies from 10,000 to 23,000 years, so I think we have a little bit of leeway there somewhere.
Okay. Well, let's grab another call or two before we wrap it up here on the Science Forum. Pete is in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Pete, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a theory about why milk is called by the pound and stuff.
Okay.
I worked on a dairy farm a long time ago, and my boss used to say, a pint is a pound the world round. And they could figure more or less how much milk was, how much the poundage was by looking at the volume in the pails and stuff.
I mean,
yeah, that's a good
and
guess.
And you know, a long time ago, the farmers before my time, they just would milk the cow and pour it into the pails and stuff to be shipped, and then they were probably paid by the pound because of the different can weights. So the farmer could get a good guesstimate about what his poundage should be.
Very interesting call. And Jim, you're
on board
with that?
Yeah, that's a good estimate for the density of water.
It's British.
It's British. Water. All right. Yeah. Ed is still on that tact. All right. Well, thanks, Pete. Appreciate the call.
I got a text from a dairy person about A2 milk.
Okay.
So A2 milk is, A2 refers to beta casein protein. And there's an A1 version and an A2 version. So it's a protein that's in milk, which makes cheese cheesy.
Right.
And there's two versions. The A2 version is easier to digest by some subpopulations of humans.
Yeah.
But most cows give a combination of A1 and A2 versions of this protein,
so
right?
Because we have two genes. Out of the A2.
So what they try to do is to breed these animals so that they only have A2 expression of these genes, no A1, and then they charge more for the milk, and it's supposed to be more digestible.
Okay. You sound skeptical.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't. I'm allergic to milk.
Are you really?
Yeah. And I'm allergic to casein. So it's the protein that I'm allergic to. It's not the lactose. So I'd be interested in checking to see if maybe my problem is an A1 problem or if it's just a casein problem.
Next show, bring an EpiPen and we'll do a test.
That's right. Well, I probably should take it the day before and then see what happens the next day.
All right. This last email here and then we'll wrap it up. This is from Ryan. There is some recent research that says birds may be using quantum entanglement in their eyes to see that magnetic field. Why are you laughing, Ed?
Oh, I'm just thinking that one bird's looking through the eyes of another bird to figure out where it's going.
It's complicated enough up there. I can't imagine.
The research is a little more nuanced than that, but thank you for that one, Ryan. All right. You're almost done with the semester now.
Yes.
At SUNY Cobleskill. What's next after the Thanksgiving break?
One week.
1 week is it?
1 week in finals.
1 week in finals.
Yeah.
Oh, this is the time that you guys get grumpiest of all.
I'm going to continue to smile
because
I'm on sabbatical.
Oh,
this is when it really pays.
I can be grumpy for her, so
that's
not
all right.
Right.
Fair enough.
That's
right. And we look forward to that next month. All right, Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, Barb Ravitch, thanks for being here. Thanks to everybody who called in. Support comes from Butcher Block, steak and seafood restaurant, Plattsburgh, serving steak and seafood, craft beers and appetizers daily, featuring a new bar and private rooms for holiday parties. Gift cards available. ButcherBlock.com. And Interactive Media Consulting, proudly supporting the opening of the Innovation Center, a new maker space in Saratoga County. InnovationCenterSaratoga.org for details. Once again, thanks to Ed and Jim and Barbara for being here, and thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. And we'll find out about this whole pounds and pints and everything. We'll figure it out for the next show. You just tune in for that. No more talk about milking the seal, though. That's off from now on. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Andrea Leong screened the calls. Thanks, Andrea. I'm Ray Graff. No show tomorrow or Friday. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. I hope your out-of-town relatives don't cause any arguments, but that's not likely. We'll see you on Monday. Stand by now for a lovely program.